This hand is your hand. This hand is my hand. Oh, wait, that's your hand. No, wait, it's my hand.
If you believe and you stand up on your feet, that was a f***ing handball. Sorry, Tim.
Well, hey, everybody. It's the Week in the Tackle podcast. 24 hours later than usual because we simply couldn't find Dunny. We searched the bordellos. We searched all of his ex-girlfriend's addresses. We searched the prisons, the poorhouses, everywhere. And we found him in the end on a flight because those days are over. And he's actually been working very hard because he's a real professional. I'm Tom Money. That's Brian Dunseth. How are you, mate? You all right?
I'm good. I'm good. Shout out to Brandon Steinecker, the Believe Anthem. I kind of tweaked it a little bit. So my buddy who's the drummer for Rancid, the original song for Real Salt Lake, I tweaked it a little bit. But yeah man, lots of flights. Lots of flights. I this will be for the travelers out there, the travelers. You've never gone through Detroit's airport. But when you land at A7 and you have to get to B10 in under 12 minutes, yeesh, and the train that you have to go up the escalator that's broken, lugging your bag, is on the other side of the airport, and then you come down the escalator and you're in a full sprint and you get the alert on your phone, you're about to miss your flight. Would you like to reschedule? And I'm like, no! I will not like to reschedule. And then you have to go down. You have to go run underneath the tarmac and then go back up the other side. And the lady at the front desk says, Mr. Dunseth, I'm glad you made it. We didn't think you were going to. And then you're sweating profusely. You're on a flight with a bunch of people that are Quebecs. And next thing you know, you are apologizing in both broken English and broken French for literally sweating all over the place next to people and dripping because you just ran over a mile to get to your gate. So that was a fun.
But you're in good shape though. You're quite a fit man. So that shouldn't. Why were you sweating so much? Was it really hot?
Were you
carrying a lot of baggage?
No, I just had my backpack. I was wearing pants because it was a bit cold. I had a t-shirt with like a light hoodie on top of it. But I sweat, man. I'm the sweaty guy. Like not like disgustingly sweat, or like I don't have a musk. I have a nice scent to me when I sweat.
But everyone thinks they've got a nice scent. But in general, no one's got a nice scent. There's no way you've got a nice scent.
I'm not like the funk sweat. If that, let's do that. I'm not
the
a funky sweat. Like I take care of myself. I got
like
lotions.
Nile Rodgers. You're not the
deodorants.
Funk.
I'm deodorant.
No wait, is that Bootsy Collins? The funk.
I take care of myself. But yeah, I don't stink when I sweat. But I sweat a lot. I'm a sweater.
That's Brian Dunseth. He does not stink. I'm Tom Rennie. This is the Week in the Tackle podcast. And Dunny's got the funk. That's something we've learned at the very start of today's program. How was it? How was the Mulls? How was the Mulls playoffs?
Oh, it, Montreal, what a city. What a city. Short turnaround time, early kickoff, afternoon kickoff, ESPN. Got to do it with Adrian Healy, my man Todd Koulis, and everybody in the booth and being in the truck. Saw Luke Wildman and Stephen Caldwell for TSN. These are like North American broadcasters. Really, really excellent. And yeah, it was a great game. Montreal ended up losing to NYCFC. NYCFC on top of them first 5 minutes, they get an early goal, lose their center back, have to change from a three back to a four, flat four. They get a killer goal right before the halftime break. They switch back. They put a kid, a homegrown product, 21 years old, who's a defensive midfielder. They put him in the back of a back three. They change their formation again. And they ended up winning, 3-1, 4-1? Yeah, 3-1, 4-1? I can't even remember. But
three.
Really, really good result. So now, Tom Rennie, they go to Emmett McConnell's Philadelphia Union, and it's a rematch of the Eastern Conference Final. But I don't know if you'll remember this. Last year, right before the Eastern Conference Final, Jim Curtin's Philadelphia Union suffered a COVID outbreak.
Yes, I remember that. Like 11 players out, didn't they?
11, 12 players out. They... excellent spirit. They did a fantastic job. They ended up losing in like the 87th minute. It was Tylas Magno, who picked up an injury after scoring in Montreal. He ended up getting the game winner on the day. So you've got a team in NYCFC that plays at Yankee Stadium, has played at Red Bull Arena as home, plays at Citi Field as home, has played at Bank of California Stadium. They've been on the road. Great spirit. Nick Cushing, who was the former Man City women's head coach, is the interim head coach for NYCFC. He's done an excellent job. And now it's a bit of, I don't know what we're going to call it, retribution, payback for Jimmy Curtin, best sneakers on the sidelines in Major League Soccer, as the Philadelphia Union will host NYCFC. And on the flip side, Austin will be on the road at LAFC for the Western Conference Final. So if LA wins, they host MLS Cup. If LA loses and Philly wins, they host MLS Cup. So,
games are on Sunday. You've been covering all these games.
Yeah.
Who's going to win both games?
Philly would be the team, if you're a betting man, you put your money on. Although New York. I don't know what the odds, Tim. Find them. Can find the odds, Tim. Sorry, Tim. That was really malicious. But I would assume,
especially
Philly,
as he's about to do you a favor. He's doing something nice for you.
He's doing you a favor. I don't care about the odds.
The one who said favorites.
Oh,
but
true.
Now we want to know if we can make some money off this. We might, if people are going to listen to this podcast, which is already, I'm sure, a weekly chore, we might as well help them out to make some fucking money. Mm. Sorry, Tim.
I would assume that Philly are the favorites. And I would assume that LAFC are the favorites.
He's looking it up. Stop assuming. He's looking it up now.
Look how slow he is. What is he on, a typewriter right now? What's happening? Horsey?
Hey, America voted against net neutrality, as I hear. So you got to pay more. You want that sweet, sweet speed.
So according to our friends at Paddy Power here, Austin FC are 5-1 to win MLS Cup. New York City FC is 9-2. The Philadelphia Union are 9-4, and LAFC is 6-5.
So LA favorites, Union second, New York third, Austin fourth.
Yep.
So I would have preferred, just as a side note, decimals. I don't like the fractions, and I just can't. Even at school, I could do fractions. I got an A in maths. Obviously, I'm not a f***ing idiot. Sorry, Tim, but I never enjoyed fractions, and you always got to do an extra layer of thinking. Yeah. Whereas decimal points are so easy and understandable to me.
100%.
So future ref decimals. Anyway, carry on.
This is where the expectations are high for both teams. The run of form, undefeated at home for Philadelphia Union against a team that really since January has, I think they were 9 weeks on the road to start the season for NYCFC from preseason through CONCACAF Champions League. They won Campeones Cup, so they do have a trophy, which is the winner of Liga MX versus the winner of Major League Soccer. They won the MLS Cup last year. Ronnie Dylan leaves in June. Nick Cushing takes over. They lose their leading goal scorer, Tati Castellanos. In the summer, in July, he had 13 goals, 2 assists. He goes to Girona, part of the Man City family. And they've got some really good dynamic players. NYCFC can score goals. Philly can score goals. I think that Eastern Conference matchup is the most, it'll be the more funner of the two.
That's the kind of word you say when you've been on planes for a few days. You've just lost your English, haven't you?
One would say more funner, or one would refuse to say more funner, as I was listening to this morning.
Someone's been listening to the show.
Been creeping on you two.
For those that missed that piece on Tuesday's Grumpy Pundits during Yacht Rock Tuesday, if you do want to avoid a row, never say you in a conversation where you're meant you. Because when you say you often, you're like, you people. But really, you could say one. Because like Her Majesty used to always say, one doesn't know if that's the right thing to do. Mm. One doesn't know if I left the chip pan out last night. One doesn't know if the dishwasher has been put on or not. And then it's more like a, you know, concept as opposed to it's your fault. Because the amount of times I've been in conversations, normally with thick people, where you've been like, well, you just do, didn't you? You say, you just do. And they go, well, I don't do that. And I was like, well, I'm not talking about you. Am I, you f***ing jerk off? I'm just saying one. So if you start saying one, then you'll get into less rows.
You gotta say sorry. Houses. You gotta say sorry.
Oh, did I jerk off?
No, you dropped in front of it. Sorry, Tim.
Did I? Sorry, I've just seen Rishi Sunak's new cabinet, and I'm absolutely furious. So I'm just dealing with the fallout of that. Anything else on MLS? Or should we move on?
Let's move on.
So on Grumpy Pundits on a Friday, when Rennie and Danny take America and Canada, we have a feature called Around the Grounds. And in our Around the Grounds picks, I utterly bombed this week, by the way, again, totally useless.
You were predicting a 15 point on Twitter.
I know. And I got, I think, 5, I think, utterly garbage. But we add our predictions for the season together and we get a season table. Brian Dunseth has got Nottingham Forest, I think, third. Was he second or third? They've been doing incredibly well.
I think
in
they were
table.
Third, and I think I had Leeds United. I think I had them fourth.
So you've got two in the bottom three, actually, in the top four.
Yeah.
Because he's got friends at Nottingham Forest, and Jesse Marsh is Moroccan, so he's been picking them to.
Dane did send me a message. Dane did. He's like, your suit's f***ing awesome. And I did get that message during the ESPN game. Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, you are. Sorry, Tim. There, I thought you were going back to.
It was a real. I can show you the text. It was a real WhatsApp.
Because you're amazing suit. for adults that wear trainers with suits, but we've got no time to do that again. Put shoes on, put some nice shoes on. Clark's
Jordan
Originals. Been retired for like 20 years. And doesn't he play baseball? Wasn't he the cartoon guy? Anyway, where was I? That was it. So Danny always picks his friends to win games. Nottingham Forest have been doing so well this season. On Friday, Tim and I were like, you keep picking Forest to win, you idiot.
You bullied me. You bullied me, you two.
They're actually bottom of the league. Stop picking them to win. It's Liverpool this weekend. They've beaten City and West Ham in the last week. They're back, baby, to quote Rio Ferdinand. And you picked Liverpool to beat Nottingham Forest. I think maybe your first Forest loss of the season.
2-1. Yeah, 2-1.
And Liverpool Forest won. Forest beat Liverpool.
Yeah.
What a guan.
Yeah. One would suggest you guys were pricks.
Yes.
But not me. Not me. I wouldn't suggest that. One would. That's, by the way, it's like saying, don't take this personal.
Yes.
But you are being an absolute knob right now. Like, you can say that, right?
Yeah, but don't take this personal is almost like, but this is a personal comment. One puts it up into the ether. Her Majesty was a very bright woman.
She very much was so.
Didn't work a day in her f***ing life. Sorry, Tim.
You hosed me. You two hosed me. You bullied me. You shamed me. You tried to make it public. You did make it public. And for the first time, I don't choose Nottingham Forest. They win. And by the way, the amount of tweets that I got from our listeners for
Grumpy Pundits
on Friday and then Week in the Tackle. By the way, leave a review.
Just leave a review.
Seconds. Please leave a review.
Leave a nice review.
That's all. Rennie's a sexual human being. I'm rather unique and funny sometimes.
Great that probably should have been the other way around.
Great singer. Great singer. Yes. Great impressionist. I was really, really impressed. It was a super nervy match. Defensively, as it always is for Nottingham Forest. And now I think we have to, we've given so much, there's so much respect that's been earned, right, from Jurgen Klopp. There's been so much respect that's been earned by the players. And we talk about blips and we talk about momentum and we've been doing this all year long where we've been avoiding this conversation. We really have. We say, oh, 10 games, give them a chance. Oh, they've got injuries, give them a chance. Oh, they'll get it right. They're Liverpool. Inevitably, they're going to get it right. It's now getting to the point where there's got to be, they're going to qualify for Europe. They're they're going to get on a run. It's inevitable.
Kind of.
But you just hope for Liverpool, if you're a fan, not a fan, who cares about Liverpool?
Yeah.
But you've got to think that this team ends up in a Champions League spot. Or is it one of those years that a team has every 4 or 5 seasons where it's so bang out of order from expectations that it's a 7th place finish. It's an 8th place finish. It's a 9th place finish.
Good.
And it's
that's how it should be.
And it's a cleaning out the cut board and recognizing that you've got to go out and spend. Because now, Rennie, we're in that conversation where you can talk about states and backing of regimes and money and who's investment and upside down investment and all of these things, which are absolutely true.
I do.
But with Liverpool, the continuum of giving contracts to players who are currently under contract, extending their contracts, keeping them around for all the right reasons, is it coming back to haunt them because of the success that they've had over the previous years?
I think that's a great point.
That's the fear for a lot of fans.
No, I think that's absolutely right. Look, I looked at this the other day after the Forest game. And it was Liverpool's first lineup under Jurgen Klopp in 2015 when they played, I think it was Tottenham away. And the thing is with Liverpool right now, it's, you know, this 7-year itch stuff with Jurgen Klopp, I don't really buy that. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting parallel and it's quite interesting and it's a nice little like thing to hang our conversation on, but I don't quite buy it. It's not the same as what happened at Dortmund. It's a similar thing and a similar time frame, but it's not the same. And that Dortmund team, first half of that season, by the way, as well, it was a real, like, it was a Charlie Foxtrot. Why am I not swearing? It was a cluster f***. Like, it really, sorry, Tim, it really sort of fell apart.
That's
for Dortmund
what Charlie
that year.
Foxtrot means?
Yes, that's why I say it, yes.
I'm in the know.
Yes, if you're ever watching a movie about Narm, and they say, it's a real Charlie Foxtrot here! And then, you know, that's
understood.
What happens. And basically, when Jurgen Klopp came in, right, he looked around this team and he was like, yeesh, we've got some real deadwood here. Look at Mikel Arteta recently at Arsenal, right? What has he done? He came in and for all the faults and criticism and conversation about Mikel Arteta, one of the best things he did was identify deadwood, identify what was wrong, move players on before he brought players in, sorted out the recruitment process, had a bit of fortune with a bit of youth development too, but has been in charge of removing Deadwood and getting his players in. There was a conversation this week about Maurizio Pochettino. Why wouldn't he go to Aston Villa? And one of the speculations was he had no idea who they were. But number two was that what they would need to do was rejuvenate this entire squad to be able to play in a way that he would want, high pressing. Maybe that's why they've gone for Unai Emery, because he's not a high pressing manager. But we'll talk about that later. So Arteta came into Arsenal, and he has been able to remove that dead wood. Jurgen Klopp did this exactly 7 years ago. And this is why I think the turnover of managers is so massive in football, because regeneration means you've got to come up with new ideas. Like, we've just had another despicable Tory prime minister in this country, and he's hired a cabinet of people who are the same pricks we've had in charge for years and years and years, but we keep cutting off the head of the snake. Another despicable right-wing hedge fund prick takes over as prime minister, right? And that's what happens in football management. A new manager comes in, they normally bring in their own people, but it takes time. So here's Jurgen Klopp's first 11, 2015. Simon Mignolet, Deadwood. Moreno, Deadwood. Mamadou Sakho, Deadwood. Martin Skrtel, Deadwood. Nathaniel Klein, Deadwood. Lucas Leiva, Deadwood. Emre Can, could have kept him. Coutinho, Deadwood. Lallana, last good year. James Milner, legend. And Divock Origi, almost the definition of footballing driftwood, Divock Origi, right? So he came in, saw that team and was like, right, got to make it a Jurgen Klopp team. And after a period of years, he did that. And then he got his team. Then he built his kind of second team. And now we're in a situation where it's transition time. So Jurgen Klopp has got to get into the mindset of a new manager and a total reset. And that's where they are now. The trouble is, it's not as easy for the same manager to do an Alex Ferguson, to regenerate in the job. And he's not got sovereign wealth fund money. He's got he's got incredible money, so no sympathy there. But he's certainly not got sovereign wealth fund, Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia money. So he's got to be a bit more canny, a bit more clever. And he's tried to do that. But look at the game against Forest the weekend. Harvey Elliott, 5 years away from being there. Same with Carvalho, Curtis Jones. It's not going to happen for Curtis Jones at Liverpool. Solid player, Wolverhampton Wanderers player. He's not going to last at Liverpool. You know, Van Dijk, how long has he got left at the top? Joe Gomez, one good game does not a defender make of quality. You know, there's elements there. And the transition's happening, but it's not happening overnight. And I think Jurgen Klopp needs the zeal of a newly appointed manager. That's what he needs now. He needs to do what Arteta did and what he did in 2015 to regenerate this team. And that's a massive job. And Dunny, that then becomes the question, is Jurgen Klopp the man to do that? And eventually the road does run out for everybody.
What is beneficial is that it's Liverpool Football Club. And when Liverpool Football Club, the phone rings and it's Jurgen Klopp on the other end, every player takes that call.
Worth is more money at Newcastle.
Give me a second, Rennie. Let me get to my point, you big jerk. This is the challenge, because this is where I think fans get caught up and miss out, because they don't think about the players' private lives, right? You don't think about the wife, you don't think about the kids, you just think about the player. Oh, he'll slot in perfectly on the left side. He'll make us so much better. Well, that's not always the case, because there's so many other variables at play. So you've got the agents, you've got the players, right? Right off the bat, you've got the wife and you got the kids. You've got the city location. Is that all of these are variables at play? You think about the pay packet. What's the wages look like? Are they in Champions League? Are they out of Champions League? Are they consistently in Champions League, or do they do what a Manchester United does? Champions League, Europe, Champions League, Europa, back and forth. Are you a team like, say, West Ham in London? You're in Conference League.
Big money.
Paqueta. What a fantastic signing. But as you rightly say, a player that could play in a couple of the other bigger teams. So that's a great signing for what. So all of the, and now with Newcastle in this conversation, we got to get to Eddie Howe and Newcastle at some point soon, because they're a top four team as of right now, which is extraordinary in such a short amount of time. But these are all some of the things that Liverpool is dealing with. And now, by the way, you've earned a reputation that you got money, but you only got so much money. And when you have a need and you need to go out and assess that issue and find a player that fits perfectly to your needs, a lot of times those special elite players are also highly valued by the clubs that you're competing with. So these are some of the initial challenges because they've got the money, but they don't have extraordinary amounts of money. And that's what Jurgen Klopp continues to talk about. But the other part of this is when they start the negotiation process, yeah, they can get Jota and they can get Darwin Nunez and they can bring Kone in and all of that, like, which is great. But I would love to really know how many other players they've lost because in the negotiation, it's, well, Man City's offering an extra $100,000 a week. Well, we can't do that. Or, yeah. Hey, Newcastle's now offering an extra $50,000
Hello?
A week.
Hello? Who's that? The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia? Sorry, I've got to take this call. Back in five.
Yeah.
Never comes back.
It's the whole, it's the whole, you know, the whole poaching behind the scenes, the U-turns of players. You know, they're supposed to be on the helicopter going to one team, and next thing you know, they're a helicopter going to South London. So, yeah, these are all really difficult realities right now for Liverpool.
I do want to move on, but I do think as well as all that, which I think is absolutely right, and I agree with all of it, I do sort of think as well, someone has taken their eye off the ball in terms of long-term recruitment. That's how you get a 36-year-old and a 19-year-old in the same team. Newcastle, you mentioned. A couple of bits on Newcastle. They beat Tottenham this weekend. Bruno Guimaraes, who, I mean, that's the first time I've really watched him. I did the commentary of the game for Premier League Live the weekend. I mean, I've obviously seen him, but first time I've done a game with Newcastle where he's played and played the majority of the game. And I read all the stats this year about, you know, the people with the calculators. Oh, football's all about the stats, you know, but like ball recoveries and ball retention and passing and all the XG and all that sort of stuff. But how many key passes? Is that a key pass? Beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop, beep, boop. Computer says no key pass, just a forward pass.
That was really good.
Thank you. But it's an American computer. Of course it is. Silicon Valley. But I thought he was just tremendous. Just tremendous performance away from home for a Newcastle team who haven't quite spent the riches yet. They bought well, but they certainly haven't bought Pele in. So credit to Eddie Howe, as you said. I think that's right to a degree, though we should probably mention occasionally the human rights abuses. But that's fine, Eddie. Keep sidestepping it. I'm sure it's a lovely place to go on holiday in December. That's the real reason. You're wearing a green short and white shirt kit. Coincidence. Anyway, that's an aside. I thought he was tremendous, terrific, amazing performance. He had everything in that game. I think he's a superstar player, Bruno Guimaraes, and I thought he was tremendous. But he actually played his wife, I think it's his wife, it says partner here, but I assume wife, gave birth to Mateo, their son, 2 days before this game. And he said post-match, he hadn't slept in the 2 days since the baby was born, which I think makes this performance even more incredible. Yeah. You've got kids, so have I. When I had our second baby, I think it was the second baby recently, I went home after, you know, the long day, you had the baby, it's very stressful, you don't sleep, there's always drama, everyone's got their stories. And I went home, didn't really sleep, came back the next day, we had the other baby to deal with the second time as well, so it's all very stressful. And then I got in the car to go back to the hospital to pick up my wife and our new baby. And I got all the way there, having driven about 40 minutes to the hospital, got out of the car and realized I put my shoes on the wrong feet. Because you just, your mind
is exhausted. Yeah,
you're exhausted. You're not thinking about it. You're a bit scrambled. And that was like 24 hours after the event. I've got a great story I always tell about a friend of mine. I won't say his name on here because he might hear this, but he'll never say it. No, I'm not doing it. But he basically went back to the hospital the day after, similar sort of story to me, went back to the hospital and got into, like, there was four women in like a ward with curtains around it. He walks in, pulls back the curtain and sees like, oh, baby's asleep. And mum's asleep as well. I'll just sit down here, and got the paper out and started reading it. About 20 minutes later, he's like, oh, she's not woken up yet. I had a quick look at her. That's not my wife. Where am I? What am I doing in here? He's basically sitting in a private ward with a woman who's just had a baby.
Yeah.
And he's just some random guy sitting in there reading the paper. Luckily, he got out of the room before she sort of woke up and the baby woke up. But you wouldn't recognize the baby. Every baby looks like Winston Churchill. Right? Don't expect me to say you've got a cute baby. There are no cute newborns. They're all ugly as sin. They're pug dogs with Churchill's face.
Some are uglier than others, let's be honest.
That's true. Yeah. But there's a baseline of Churchill. Yeah. They get pretty often after like a week, maybe 2 weeks. But immediately when they come out, you know,
they like no longer look like a worm.
Yes, they go from like a worm with a raisin's face to like a person. Anyway, the reason I say all that is because he played incredibly and I couldn't even put the shoes on the right feet. Your thoughts?
I think that you, by the way, do you hear about these sleep nannies that people come into your house and like, sleep through the night and like they,
my friend
take care
does this.
Of your kid?
This is crazy.
Sorry,
staggering.
Tim. I know I've cursed a lot today. I can't wrap my head around this. Why in the world? Why in the world would you allow anyone in your house to keep your baby alive while you're just having a rest upstairs?
It's what rich people do. This is how really rich people live.
Sorry.
This is how rich people live.
Yeah. I can't.
You think that Kardashian mom ever stayed up with her kids?
Which
one?
Not
a fucking chance.
Which one?
Sorry, Tim. Not a chance. That Kardashian mom has barely met her kids. I refuse. Yeah, she just hires
other
somebody.
People's carrying other people's kids and all that. You know, here's the thing. As a father, there's not much we do in the beginning.
No.
Learner's permit for every young listener out there in the beginning. You're worthless. You're a worthless dad. You just sit there. You rock the baby. You clean up the mustard poop. And that's pretty much it.
I mean, I'm not sure that's strictly true, but it does give us an insight to what a lazy dad you are.
I'll tell you this. How dare you? Because I don't have a real job, because I live in a fantasy world,
yes.
I would get all my three boys, I got up with my wife every feeding time. Because yes. I didn't have responsibilities for
someone's always primary caregiver though. I think that's a fact.
We were next to each other and we would talk to each other, we watch shows, so she would feed the babies and I was a burping specialist. I always got the burps out. She'd hand me the baby.
What about the kids?
I would burp the babies. But when you realize that for Bruno, the opportunity to play, get out and do what you're best at. That's what guys want to do. They want that opportunity to go out and play. So
yeah, and he was great.
He would have had every excuse not to play. The fact that he did and played such an incredible level, extraordinary. All the moms out there, you're amazing.
Yeah. The other question on that game I wanted to ask you was about the Callum Wilson goal. We had a chat about this on Monday, got loads of responses actually on @SiriusXMFC. A few calls as well. So Callum Wilson scores this goal. It's a big pump up field. Fabian Scher, I think. Hugo Lloris comes out, who, I mean, does drop the occasional clanger, despite making some great saves in midweek, still dropped a clanger in that game at Old Trafford. He hits him on the thigh, and then they run into each other. And then Callum Wilson picks it up, chips it into the net. Lloris, for a second, tries to pretend he's injured, but then realizes, actually, I'm not going to get away with this. But he hasn't got up in time to do anything about it. So I'll tell you right now, we did an hour and a half on this on Monday. Loads of calls, loads of messages. Tommy and I talked about it on the show. And I don't really feel any clearer on it now as to when I did then. I could easily see this being given as a foul by Callum Wilson, who ran into Hugo Lloris, instigated the contact, and that's a foul by him. I could easily be persuaded now that Hugo Lloris commits a foul by miscontrolling the ball, and then he runs into Callum Wilson in a panic, and that's a free kick the way of Newcastle. And I can also be convinced that it's a natural collision between the two players. Play on as the referee decided and the VAR agreed, and Callum Wilson chips it home. So I don't have a firm position, bizarrely, on any of these things. What say you?
I don't understand why Hugo Lloris didn't step further to his left on the judgment of the through ball when the ball came through, and why he didn't take a step to it. Well, he's right. He's left-footed. I mean, you could go either way, but the ball hits him in his right thigh. I don't know why he just doesn't step and hit like a side volley or open up his right foot with the instep and just lift one up away from Callum Wilson chasing him down. So that's number one. I watched the replay over and over. And I was like, why does he just, I know the ball skips up on him, but he wasn't ever prepared. He kind of like took it. He wasn't sure if he was taking it with his thigh or to take it with his chest. And the idea, what he was trying to do was push it past Callum Wilson with his first touch. But he just ruined that first touch. Not all collisions are a foul. I think if you are Newcastle, you've got two players going in the same direction. So whose fault could it truly be? It felt like for me that it was more of a foul for Hugo Lloris' impact on Callum Wilson than Callum Wilson's impact on Hugo Lloris. I had no problem with the referee continuing to play. I think this is also a trickle-down effect where I have no idea why Eric Dyer, I know his instinct is to call for a foul because his goalkeeper is out of the blocks, but he stops playing. I don't know if he can get to the ball, but he stops playing as well. But I agree with you. This is one of those gray areas because Spurs fans will want the foul. Newcastle fans will want the opportunity to play on that there is no foul. And this is the gray area again. Well, actually, it's not a gray area because the referee did a good job. He allowed the play to continue to then afford, because VAR was going to check it, was there a clear and obvious mistake made by the referee? And I don't think in that collision there's necessarily a foul on either. But I could also see, like you said, the referee calling a foul on Callum Wilson, and I could also see the referee calling a foul on Hugo Lloris.
Unai Emery is back in the Premier League. He is the manager of Aston Villa now. I do want to get your view on that because I think that's a fascinating decision from Unai Emery, who's been in charge of Sevilla, Villarreal, and now Aston Villa. I do want to talk about that and get your view on that. But I wanted to ask you first about the Brentford game the weekend that Aston Villa played and they won 4-0. How much did those players hate Steven Gerrard? I mean, I'm sorry. You see them play all season, and we've spoken about Villa a fair amount, and uninspired, confused, dour, low energy, complaining, whinging, bitching, moaning, all that sort of stuff. The utter misery of Steven Gerrard's post-match press conferences. They have a game against Brentford where they're being coached by, his name has totally escaped me, career coach, Aaron Danks. I want to say Aaron Danks might be his name.
It's Danks,
Oh, good. And they beat Brentford 4-0. And that first 20 minutes was wild, wild, aggressive, and just superb. They blew them away. Talk to me about that. I mean, I saw a great tweet from a guy called Chris, Aston Villa fan, who said, quote, proof that Steven Gerrard should never manage a football club ever again. Mm. Thoughts?
This was a weird one, watching the success that Steven Gerrard had at Glasgow Rangers, right? And then coming to the Premier League. And ultimately being undone. But I mean, as much as we're talking about what happened to Steven Gerrard, what has happened to Coutinho? My God, what a drop off from the player that he once was. There is a conversation to be had about elite of the elite of the elite players not doing well as managers and the support system that's needed with a staff that can communicate very, very well with players. Because sometimes, and I just heard this conversation with Thierry Henry a couple of weeks ago over here in the States while doing the Champions League coverage, that when you're with players and you're asking them to do something that seems so unbelievably simple for you and they can't do it, it becomes personal. It's no longer a coaching thing. It's a self-belief that you don't believe in these players.
Steven Gerrard is not Thierry Henry, though, Danny.
I mean, no. I'm not talking about hitting the ball in the box. But no, we're talking about midfield and connecting.
We're talking
passes.
About Thierry Henry. Thierry Henry was a virtuoso player, so I fully get the point on Thierry Henry, and I accept that. Steven Gerrard, though a great player, and I'm not denigrating his playing career,
elite player,
but he's not. He wasn't. Thierry Henry was a genius. Steven Gerrard was an incredibly excellent functional player. He was able to do everything brilliantly well, I think through sheer force of will a lot of the time, rather than incredible technical ability. I mean, again, that feels like I'm critiquing him, but Henry is one thing. Henry is like, he's like Maradona and, you know, these people that just did stuff. You see what I mean?
I understand there's
Gerrard understands the functionality of the game.
I understand. Put him in the same boat as Frank Lampard.
Yeah. Okay.
There's moments in which you're asking your team in terms of identification in a split second, reading the game, feeling the game, sorting things out on the field, tactical discipline, stepping up, dropping back, covering shoulders, shape with the body, how to play out of pressure. All of these things. I mean, who is Douglas Luiz better than Steven Gerrard? Was the Donker better than Steven? Was Jack McGinn better than Steven? No. They're not. So there becomes a point where I would assume there's frustration that continues to build and build and build and build and build. So we can talk about Michael Beale and we can talk about his staff. We can talk about all of these
things.
Can I jump
in again? Yeah. Just one more time, because I think this is really interesting. Is Pierre-Emile Højbjerg a better midfielder than Antonio Conte was?
No.
Conte's improved Højbjerg. So why couldn't Gerrard improve Luis?
But you're talking about an elite manager. Steven Gerrard's not an elite manager. Steven Gerrard's still in the infancy of his managerial career. What Antonio Conte has done and the respect that he has isn't about what he was as a player. It's about what he is as a manager. Steven Gerrard did a phenomenal job at Glasgow Rangers, but the respect he has isn't as a manager. It's because he's Steven Gerrard. Sorry, Tim. that's different. So again, I'd be naive to suggest I understand what's happening behind the scenes, but when you see a team come out like it's been a caged animal stuck in the zoo and it's the first time it's got open land and it's free to be expansive and do what they need to do, because when you look at these players, I mean, outside of Jack McGinn, John McGinn, who else in this team isn't quote unquote a starting player for Aston Villa underneath Steven Gerrard? There wasn't a lot of changes, right? There's not a, but it's the feel. And so we talk about the proverbial bounce, right? The new manager bounce. What would this all look like? This is a better team than how they've been playing. So whatever the shape, identity, tactics, what Steven Gerrard wanted, this team came out and said, "F that." Sorry, Tim again. We're going to show how good. This was an ego performance. This was a collective ego performance. We're not a terrible team. We're better. The manager got sacked. Now it's our opportunity to prove. And by the way, Steven Gerrard probably looked at that performance. He didn't watch. He probably walked away. But if he goes back and watches this performance, he has to then internalize and ask, why did this team turn up and play this well after what these last couple of weeks have looked like?
From your playing career, extensive playing career in various countries, do players down tools to get a manager out? And is that what happened here?
I tread this lightly.
Because it's yes, but you can't tell us.
No. There are... See, here's what happens. It's not necessarily about getting the manager out. The manager will suss himself out no matter what.
Yeah.
How quickly or how long that takes, the decision makers will figure that out. Because what happens is it's less about downing tools. It's more about acting out. And when leadership acts out or the players act out, then it starts with there's a problem in the squad. And that goes above the manager's head to the board of directors. And they recognize. And what the early warning sign should have been was Tyrone Mings being stripped and dropped and challenged publicly. That was the first, for me, this is just as a player. These are just going through my mind experiences that I've had. Because it starts with one of your senior players. You're either backing the manager 100% or the senior players start whispering inside the boot room, the locker room, on the field, walking to the field. And when the whispers start and the frustration starts, then it's acting out in the training sessions. And it's questioning the coaching staff and the assistants, and then it's the manager. And a lot of it happens during video sessions. Why are we playing this way? Do we really need to be that deep? Do we need to play zonal marking here? Can we step a little bit higher? Can we start our line of contention at midfield? No, I want you to just drop it. There becomes like debates that happen. Then it's about player selection, substitution pattern. Those are getting frustrated. And then ultimately, it's about the losses that build up. That's what gets managers sacked. So this idea of downing tools, there's too much pride that happens for players to down tools. Because guess what? All of these guys, Danny Ings, Watkins, et cetera, Buendia, they don't want to get hammered in the press. They don't want it to make it look like they're the problem. No, it's the manager's problem. Like, he's the problem. Don't give me a rating of 4 out of 10. Like, we didn't play well, but that's not our fault. Like, we're set up not to play well. It's naive how we're being set up to play. So all of those things out. But I also have been...
They still can't give their best, though, can they, in that scenario?
Douglas
Luiz shining on the right wing, might be a professional, and he's still not running as hard as he did against Brentford.
It's different, right? But here's also what happens, and I've been in a team that actually we won. I gotta be careful how far I go on this one. We won a trophy that season. We ended up going to the semifinal in another one, and it was despite the coach. Everybody on our group, and we had a bunch of established players on this team. It was basically throughout the week, it was tactical session and it was video session. And there was like an understanding amongst the team, like a little wink, that you knew that come game time, we were just going to play. We were just going to go out and play. We were going to play our... And to the point where, like, you come in the team huddle and it was like, despite everything that we've been working on this week, guys, let's do us. We got this. Let's just play. That was the understanding amongst the players. And so the coach looked like a genius because we kept winning. But in reality, none of us were listening to the coach or the coaching staff.
Didn't they say anything? Didn't they notice you were playing?
No, because we were winning. Like we do like the broad stroke, right? Oh, the 3-5-2 or the 3-4-3 or the 4-4-2 with the diamond. Like as from the outside looking in, we are looking to justify what we're seeing to put like a label to it. Man, when you're a player, it's such moving parts. It's always moving parts. And you know when you're playing well. You can feel when you're chasing the game. You know when you're, oh, we're on today. Bop, 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 bop. Look at the way the ball's pinging around, skipping around. Like, you know. Like, you, there's a feel. And these players know when they're playing well. So when they're not playing well and they're being asked to stand, it's not downing tools, but when they're asking, okay, the opponent's better. Okay, we got to be concerned about this. Or we got to be, no, that's not what players want. Players want to be like, all right, let's make them be concerned about us. Let's make them worry about us. Like, good. Yeah, we know these guys. It doesn't matter. Like, okay, cool. Overlapping run on the ride. And this guy's really good in possession. He can wiggle his way out. Blah, 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 blah. That's great. Nah, man, let's go play. Let's press them. Let's see what they got. Like, they, you know,
unless you are totally bought into the first scenario, I suppose, as well. That's kind of what happened to Steven Gerrard. If you can buy into it, that's the Mourinho-Conte thing.
I believe it. Yeah.
I do want to ask some more questions. I want to cover as much ground as we can because there's so many things I want to talk to you about.
There. Sorry, I just
you did. No, it's fine.
History.
But you know, we got your point. I wanted to ask you about Unai Emery going to Villa. I wanted to get your view on that because I think that's incredible. We spoke to a Spanish football expert who said it was a bit handshakes all round at Villarreal. You know, he got them to the Champions League semi-final, lost to Liverpool, won them the Europa League, beat Man United in that final, the De Gea missed penalty and all that. Currently, I think seventh in La Liga, but there's a feeling it's kind of run its course, had to pay like £5-6 million to get him to Villa. Your thoughts on Unai Emery deciding to go to Aston Villa, back to the Premier League, where he doesn't have the best reputation, let's put it that way. I think it's over-egged how bad people think he was, but also he's not remembered fondly by Arsenal, the club he was at.
It was a really difficult... Well, I don't think he's thought fondly of a PSG as well. Right. And so he went into two club systems that had big personalities, big players, and didn't come out looking good. Could not create a structure that was functional enough. And listen, that's been the problem at PSG from the beginning to now, because of the power of the players inside of that locker room. He was one of many that didn't come out looking well. The Arsenal time was a big transition period, right? Big transition period. So you have new ownership, new identity, new leaders behind the scenes. Mr. Goldeneye, Sven Mislintat, coming over from Borussia Dortmund, being pushed out the door. And before Edu walks in, right? And still dealing with the power struggle of guys, whether you're talking about Willian, you're talking about David Luiz, you're talking about Mesut Ozil being the most difficult. Is he sick or does he have a back issue? It was like every single week he wasn't trapped. So, for Unai Emery, the success that he's had in La Liga in Spain, spectacular, extraordinary. He's a really good manager. He takes a ton of stick. And by the way, for all of those that like make fun of him, and I know it's been a punchline, good evening. The fact that he's tried so hard to learn a second language, we should be commending him as opposed
Can
to-
Can I say something on that?
Yeah.
Just something on that. I do think that's a little bit overplayed. Just a little bit. Yeah. Only because like, I think- people try to turn that debate, and maybe it is for some people, but I don't think it is for en masse. They try to turn it into a language thing and a kind of xenophobic thing. I actually don't quite buy that. And I also think if I worked in Germany and every time I'd done an interview, I started with a good tag, I think people would in Germany would quite rightly take the piss out of me. And I don't think I would have to take that seriously or have German people defend me on the grounds of xenophobia. I think it was really odd. At the start of every interview, he said good evening.
It is odd.
The fact he said it with a B, I don't think is the reason that everyone went so mad about it. It was the fact he said good evening at the start of every post-match interview and pre-match interview, which no one does. And that's fair game. I think it's unfair that we call people like xenophobic or whatever the appropriate word would be because we made a joke out of it. Some things are just funny for f***'s sake. Something is just a joke. Just let's have some fun. You know, if it goes to a xenophobic place, fine, we'll knock it on the head. But I don't think that's what this was. Anyway, carry on. Sorry.
I get it, but it was a punchline. And whether he was in on the joke, which I don't think he was, or didn't ever realize that, and it could be something as simple as it was a cultural thing, right? This is how he in Spain said hello to everybody. Good evening, good afternoon, whatever it was, and brought it in. It could be a nerves thing as well. Just be nervous when he's going in to step in front, and this is how he starts it. So he got a ton of shtick, like right, wrong, or indifferent. He got a ton of stick for it. I think, listen, it's the allure of the Premier League. Aston Villa is still a huge club. Like the size of Aston Villa is massive, massive, massive. It's not now on the tip of everybody's tongue as all of the other top four, top five, top six teams are. That's reality. They've had difficulties, but it's still Aston Villa, right? It's incredible fan base, huge club. Money's great. Players are better. It's Premier League. And I think that he feels as though he's got unfinished business, that it didn't go right. It didn't go well. It could have been much better. And he was the guy who took the fall for what is becoming a really great manager in Mikel Arteta to turn Arsenal around. So I was like you. When I saw it on Twitter, I was like, what? Unai is going to take Aston Villa? I didn't think that never dawned on me that was the direction that they would go. But it actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think this is a better squad, and it might fit perfectly, whatever we're calling it, a 4-2-3-1, that identity, that shape. I think there's a couple of really good players that he could work with, and I'd be interested to see what kind of tweaks he makes to this group.
Yeah, I agree. Brilliant appointment. I do want to get through some other bits, and I've got a really, I think, interesting question to you that kind of compares David Moyes and Jesse Marsh. I do want to get to, but I can't start talking about West Ham without talking about the handballs. because I do want to get your view on it, but I do want to give mine as well, because it was really, they were both really interesting, I thought, the West Ham Bournemouth game. And, you know, it was a tough game of football, which we'll talk about in a minute. But in terms of the handballs, I thought the penalty, I don't think there's much debate in terms of the penalty, because, you know, there was a famous Paul Pogba one a few years ago. They do happen quite regularly. You know, we talk about natural position and all that sort of stuff of the arms. And you can dive to the ground to block across without flailing your arms up in the air like, someone tweeted this to me earlier on. I wish I'd have saved it now. Wacky waving inflatable arm man from Family Guy. Someone sent this to me earlier.
That's a really
good
one.
You know, Jordan Zamora goes down like he's wacky waving inflatable flailing arm tube man. Like, and it's not necessary. You can keep your arms down by the side. I don't buy it. He did try and make his arms unnaturally bigger. That's a penalty. And I think that's case closed. The other one, I'd love to see what you think about it, because I was there at London Stadium watching the game, and we're in this era now, and people who know me will know this. I don't really celebrate goals until it's the third goal. And I've always kind of been like that, really. I've been to see us twice, 3-0 up and lose 4-3. So I don't really celebrate goals. The third goal, though, I'll celebrate happily. But also in this era as well, you just know they're going to find a way to disallow it. The Rashford one the other week was a joke, you know, so you can't celebrate it. But I watched it, and I'm kind of in line with that corner in a way, slightly to the right as you're looking, and it looked like handball.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like I'm looking directly at it. I'm kind of next to the TV camera. So I'm basically watching the same thing people on TV are watching. It looks like a handball from Tilo Kehrer, right? The goal is given. I didn't celebrate it. And a couple of people that were near me, Paul Parker was in front of me doing BBC London. He turns around and was like,
yeah.
And I'm like, it's handball. Yeah. Like, I'm not, it looks like handball. It feels like handball. It has to be given as handball. It's then not given as handball. And there was an amazing Twitter video someone posted, and they superimposed a volleyball net on the image. And it was like Tilo Kehrer pumped it over the net before someone spikes it down. Now, it wasn't given, and I think this is interesting, because I do think this was handball, because I think Tilo Kehrer moves his arm towards the ball, so I would give it. However, it wasn't given because they say, where else would you put your arms? And actually, I think there's a good defense of that. He puts his arms almost across his body.
It's in front of his body, yeah.
So he's not making them unnaturally bigger. So I don't think you're going to win that debate in terms of unnaturally bigger, unnatural position. It does hit the red zone for handball, but the debate then comes, is it deliberate? Now, I feel like it is, and in real time, I thought it was, but I could happily be convinced by Mike Dean. Thanks for staying at VAR, Mike. Bring me that drama. I can happily be convinced that Tilo Kehrer can't do anything else with his arms, and so that's why they give it. Gary O'Neill, Bournemouth boss, livid. Should be disallowed. The other element to this as well, before I get your view on it, is that they said, it's a new phase of play, essentially, when the Bournemouth defender clears it. So it can't be given as an accidental handball, which is why deliberate is the conversation. They decided it's not deliberate. But it doesn't lead to an immediate goal. The ball was in the net 4 seconds later. That can't be right.
And there was no clearance of the ball. The ball comes off. First off, I think it's absolutely handball. Absolutely a handball. If that's not a handball, what in the f*** is? Sorry, Tim. His hands to his body. I don't think he means to handball it when it comes in, but he makes a motion. He definitely makes like a lifting motion with his, he's not extending his arm up over his head, but he's kind of like jumping at the ball a little bit as it pops off him. Defender clears it, not even past the penalty spot before the ball's headed back in. Zuma, it's a great header, redirection header. It's a fantastic goal. Letter of the law, I guess it stands. But if that's not a handball, I don't know what is. For me, 100%. The broadcasters in the States, handball. The studio desk analyst, double handball. And nobody could believe that it was actually given. So
they didn't agree over here, you know. They didn't. It was Sean Dyche and Jamie Carragher doing the TV, and it was David Connolly for us on Premier League Live, and they all thought it was a fair goal, no handball.
I think if you are Bournemouth, if any of those guys are associated with Bournemouth, they're popping their top that they can't believe that this. I think it was absolutely a handball, absolutely a handball. Yeah.
But then the debate then comes to, is it deliberate or not? And if it's not given on the field, we're at that high bar again.
Yeah.
And of course, West Ham last week got robbed by VAR, so I was okay with it. I wanted to ask you this, Danny. I thought it was quite interesting, this. We were chatting to Phil Hay on Grumpy Pundits on Tuesday, man who covers Leeds in great detail for The Athletic. And we were talking about Jesse Marsh and his lovely Lululemon stretch pants, which I didn't know what they were. You said it a lot, and I've looked them up, and they're just jeggings, just expensive jeggings.
Super comfortable.
We have Sweaty Betty leggings over here, which I've discovered, which are all the mums down the school. They've all got them on, every one of them. They've all got this. I now I've looked it up, and everyone's like, oh, you're looking at the mum's backside. No, I'm just seeing where they bought the leggings. Very interesting.
Sure. Keep telling yourself that.
Yes. Well, that's what I told my wife. She's got many a pair. I know, because I had to pay for them. But the interesting thing for me is, so I went to the West Ham game. West Ham went into that game in 17th place because of the results and the way the weekend was and how the table was just a little bit tight at the moment. We're about 5 to 8 weeks away from it really stretching out. And David Moyes went into the game in the same way he went into the Wolves game previously when West Ham were in a bit of trouble. And he was ultra pragmatic. Like, West Ham are better than their performance to beat Bournemouth, significantly so. I know they were out of Paqueta and whatnot, but they were intentionally extremely cautious. They know they were overwhelming favourites to win the games, and they went completely risk-averse against Bournemouth. And they won the game through a couple of controversial goals. But look, we talked today with West Ham moving from 17th to 10th. And that matters. The optics of that matter. West Ham could have gone into the game on Sunday against Man United, bottom of the league, if results didn't go their way. So it was crucial they did not lose to Bournemouth and preferably win that game. And they've done that twice and they've got the wins twice. And that gets some stick. I was on the train with a bunch of West Ham fans who were not happy with the performance. They were not happy with the way they played. They weren't happy with the risk-averse nature of it. Jesse Marsh, on the other hand, went into a game this weekend against Fulham, Leeds United States America against Fulham America, and he went hell for leather, full throttle, pedal to the metal. And even when they were winning in the game, they still were just so offensive and so kind of, frankly, disorganized. They looked disorganized. They looked like they're a bunch of dogs chasing cars. And Fulham played a professional game of football and won the game in the end by 3-2. And I suppose my question to you is, do you think Jesse Marsh is able to display the pragmatism that people like David Moyes and recently Frank Lampard too have gone towards to get up the table before thinking about being more expansive and being more entertaining? Or is Jesse going to live and die by whatever it is he's trying to achieve. And I don't think whatever it is coming across particularly well. And I don't see it being anywhere near the caliber of Bielsa. And Phil Hay made an interesting point that the players don't look anywhere near as fit now as they did under Bielsa, which I thought was quite interesting, which I hadn't considered before. Do you think he will continue to do this crazy, just disorganized mishmash kind? Or can he go 6-3-1 and get a draw in games that it's important now because they need points?
Yeah. I don't agree that the team doesn't look fit. I don't agree that there's not a style of play. I don't agree that there's not a tactical shape that Jesse has installed with this group. It just looks different than Bielsa. And now all of a sudden we were talking about Bielsa ball and running all over the field. And that's the way you got them. If I'm not mistaken, Bielsa was sacked because of how poor they were playing. Because of the way that they were playing.
Playing better than this though.
Were they? I mean, listen, I'm not trying to defend Jesse, but the reality is he was sacked because there was serious concern about the group at the time and the way that they were playing and the threat of being relegated. So that was all on the table for Jesse. I don't think so. It's an interesting dynamic because it's a really fascinating conversation because we could say Eddie Howe had to do the same thing, right? Down tactics to get results, to save Newcastle and climb them out. And it worked really, really well. So this will be the biggest challenge. It was a challenge for Lampard. It's a challenge for Moyes, and it'll be a challenge for Jesse. Do you sacrifice your internal philosophy to figure out a way to just steady the ship? Steady the ship. Cooper right now at Nottingham Forest, steady the ship. I'll tell you what was missing. Tyler Adams was a really big miss for this game, getting drug all over the place. Luke Ayling had a shocker. I know he almost scored. He was all over the place, and it was very easy to see why he wasn't a consistent starter so far in this season. They look super nervous when they don't have the ball and they're in transition defending. Whether you're talking about Cock off the line, Cooper in the back, the balance between the two center backs never feels strong enough. Throw Llorente into that conversation. Never feels strong enough. He made changes, and those six changes, one enforced with the injury to Tyler Adams, he was let down by a couple of these players for performances. And maybe that is the lack of the lack of understanding amongst each other, even though I hate using that because the guys train with each other every single day. But credit to Fulham. I mean, if you're going to give up a Mitrovic goal at the near post with a glancing header off a corner kick, that is the ease. This whole narrative of like, oh, they're great in the air, they're great. Like, one of the things that you can control is your individual matchups on set pieces and corners. And it always feels really nervy with Leeds for some reason.
Because they're still doing zone, aren't they? I mean, no one was marking Mitrovic.
Zone. Yeah, it's half zone. But
why are they marking
it?
Mitrovic? I mean,
Was it Sinisterra was responsible?
I think so.
For him,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it was bad marking. It was poor marking. I mean, you got to put one of your big bodies on him. But listen, yeah, there's nothing to justify Jesse's decisions right now with the run of form. I think that the club wants to keep Jesse. I think they believe in what Jesse's doing. I heard the interview with Phil. I think once you get the away crowd against you, the hardcore travelers, that's hard to overcome. I think a majority of the fans are still skeptical. I think his background as American still comes into play in the back of people's minds. I think it absolutely does. And he is under a tremendous amount of pressure right now to figure it out, and it doesn't get any easier for Leeds United. So I think if he can stabilize and be pragmatic, which I don't see as Jesse's strength, I think Jesse, I think he'll bend, but he'll never break. If they could get into the international break, I think then that affords him a rethink. I think it affords the club a rethink. I think it a deep dive to what they're doing and what can be better, and then ultimately pushes them into the transfer window where they can have ideas. And this is a broad stroke for everyone. The World Cup break is going to afford everybody the opportunity to assess, reestablish, and then focus on how quickly I think this transfer window is. We're going to see a lot of work done early in the window because clubs are going to try to get players in as quickly as possible. But yes, Jesse's in a ton of trouble and he has to figure out a way to get results. And if being pragmatic and giving up some of his philosophical coaching ideas is the way, well, then he's going to have to do that or he's going to fall on the sword.
And just really briefly on that, I do want to say that, you know, I've supported a team for years that really struggled to win these games against crap teams at home.
Yeah.
And it is a real skill. It's an actual skill. And you see when managers panic, and we've done this at West Ham in my life, following them as a fan. And you see it a lot when you watch any team, managers move away from what they actually believe will work at their peril. Because when they do it, often it doesn't work and everyone loses faith then. Even the believers lose faith. So it's a really interesting time now for Jesse Marsh. I don't think he can do the Moyes thing because he's not Moyes. Mm-hmm. I don't think he can do it. I think Lampard could do it at Everton because no one knew what a Frank Lampard team was. So they're finally buying into something for the first time ever. But there's got to be something else. There's got to be a change at Leeds that doesn't go full, you know, Moyesiah, but certainly moves away from Marsh mess. Yeah, that was good. That worked. Week in the Tackle is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. Subscribe today wherever you stream your podcasts.